welcome once again to From the Center, podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I am known as Jack Vowell from the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my colleague and friend, the director for the Center of Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, good to see you again.
Thank you, Jack. I'm glad to see you too. I'm glad to talk to you as Jack, but I also know you as Jonathan, and I know lots of people that know you as Jonathan.
Yeah, so. It gets confusing for people. I tell them it's like the importance of being earnest. I'm like Jack in town and John in the country.
Right.
Or however that worked.
Oscar Wilde. Bunburying.
Gosh, and muffins.
And muffins. That's a great play. Well, we decided last time that maybe there were some other elements of this Paris statement that we might want to get into, and I think I have a couple I'd love to share with you. Let's take a couple. This is such an important statement because, well, let me say this. The concept of conservatism, I think, gets a bad rap these days because it seems...
Do you?
Because it seems like whenever the word comes up, what's heard is not necessarily what is meant by it. Mm. And I guess I want to redeem the word a little bit here. And I think this Paris statement is an example of how that sort of could be redeemed. It's an example of it, not the only way to say it by any means. But the idea is that conservatism ends up looking like, you end up looking to the people that you use it with as an old man standing on your front lawn, shaking your fist and going, "You kids, get off my lawn."
Right.
You know, I don't want anybody to have any fun. I'm holding on to the old ways and they're the best ways and I'm not going to change anything. And that just looks stagnant and...
It's Topol singing tradition.
Exactly, exactly. So, and it's Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino.
Holding his M1.
Like
off my lawn type thing. Right?
That's it. That's the idea. And I think that image is simply, it's true for some people, I suppose. There are some that think that way. But when we talk about conservatism here, we're talking about something that actually has roots back to Edmund Burke and T.S. Eliot and to Russell Kirk. And what you might call paleoconservatism that has an actual positive message. It's not just, I don't want anything to change. It's saying this is what a moral imagination looks like, an imagination of the world, a vision of the world that is fed by healthy, deep, eternal, transcendent kind of truth.
Yeah, conservatism could get a bad rap precisely because it feels like there is a disconnect from its first principles, and thus in the popular imagination, but even within so-called conservative circles themselves. I mean, for goodness sake, people consider Alex Jones from like InfoWars as a conservative. And I'm like,
right.
Me as someone who is a conservative and holds to its first principles, I'm like, how could you possibly associate it with that? But it does. It can. It's like when you use the word, all that baggage gets thrown in. Of course, if you looked at the scope of it and saw like Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk, Newt Gingrich, George W. Bush, Trump, Alex Jones, and at least one point Milo Yiannopoulos were all called conservative.
Exactly.
You're like, how does that all work? Because I'm pretty sure most of these people would be just aghast at each other for various different reasons.
And throw into that mix the KKK.
And the mix, yeah. It's like, how does that all...
How could they all be conservatives?
How can that all work together? And then, of course, the answer is it can't. You know,
right.
There is actually some sort of principled version of conservatism that is, like, if I may put it this way, the true kind of conservatism in which everything else is either a splinter, a perversion, or a deficiency, or an excess, or something like that.
That's right.
It's arguable. We go back to Edmund Burke on it because he was one of the first to articulate what would be called in modern terms a conservative political or philosophical position. But it's arguable that Burke wasn't inventing anything, that he was just asserting something that had been around forever, most of society.
He was applying it to the French Revolution in particular. Edmund Burke, you know, was a fan of the American Revolution, strangely enough, but an opponent of the French Revolution. So he had some very subtle distinctions to be made.
Yeah, the way Roger Scruton argues about it is that, and others have argued this too, I think Russell Kirk himself was very hesitant to try and write down like solid principles or axiomatic points about conservatism, because he was like, conservatism is less a axiomatic ideology and more like a mood or like a temperament or an attitude towards things. Roger Scruton argued similarly, where he said that conservatism, he said conservatism is the philosophy of love, which, for those of you who have been burned by conservatives in the past, I'm sure you want to scoff at such a notion. And there is a little bit of marketing, it feels like, calling it that. But what he meant is that conservatism doesn't start with some political ideology or like limited government or supporting the monarchy or whatever, depending on where you're from. Conservatism starts with an attitude or a disposition of love towards something that you want to protect and conserve.
Exactly.
Right. That's exactly. And he says everybody has that. The example he used was of his father, his own father, who was a dyed-in-the-wool socialist and who wanted like workers' rights and wanted that daggum monarchy needs to come tumbling down and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
But when, I can't remember who it was, it might have been a socialist outfit or something, came into his own town and wanted to undo something that had been sort of a traditional staple of his local village,
mm-hmm.
that gave sort of a life enrichment to the village, suddenly he was really conservative about that. He was like, no, don't you dare touch. This thing is good and needs to stay.
Protection.
In truth, if you pushed anyone, there's something that everyone, even the most radical left-wing anarcho-communist, there's something in their life that they're conservative about, that if it was threatened, they would want to preserve it.
Right.
And conservatism is just that spirit or attitude, if I could put it this way, projected into like the socio-political sphere. It's like there are certain political systems or principles or fundamental principles, social norms or moral principles or transcendent ideas that need to be conserved for the good of a society.
Right.
Right. It's that kind of attitude.
That's right. And that brings me to an interesting recollection. In past podcasts, we have talked a little bit about this idea, but it's not so much that there's a progressive world and a conservative or a progressive mindset and a conservative mindset, and the two of them are somehow pitted against each other in the square. It's just as you say, that everybody is conservative about certain things. So the question isn't, will you be a conservative or not? The question is, what do you want to conserve?
Yes.
Right? So then you have to have a value system. You have to have some kind of moral order that gives you an understanding of what needs to be preserved and what needs to be adjusted.
Right, and everybody has a moral system.
And everybody's got it. You mentioned that Kirk doesn't want to put conservatism into a set of bullet points,
right.
And
he,
you're right. But he also did try.
He did. He did try. I remember.
He tried it. And it was. I'm going to just read a few of them here, just for fun. He said, "This is. You can find this in the Kirk Center, Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal, 10 Conservative Principles by Russell Kirk." And what he says first is the conservative believes that there exists an enduring moral order.
Right.
So that's this transcendent idea that things actually are the same. Enduring things are the same for every generation and need to be understood and applied in every generation.
A conservative isn't a moral relativist exactly.
Right.
They believe there's a fundamental order to things. Whether you believe in a Judeo-Christian sense that it's a logocentric order in God, or you believe in sort of a modern, you know, Jordan Peterson-esque way that there's some kind of fundamental ordering principle within us that somehow acts out in some ways.
Right.
Conservatism, I don't know if Jordan Peterson would call himself a conservative, but conservatism believes there is an enduring moral order.
Right.
One that's bigger than your own private sort of assessment of.
That instills a kind of epistemological humility from the outset. It means that neither the individual nor the culture at large are the ultimate authority. There's something higher than all of us that we all have to adhere to.
Right. There's something bigger than yourself. There's something bigger than your small town. There's something bigger than your government.
That's right.
That's right. That is the rubric by which we measure what's right and wrong, what's good and evil.
Second, it says, the conservative adheres to custom, convention, and continuity. Everybody does this too, in the way that you were just saying, that everybody has something he wants to conserve. So everybody understands that. But the question then is, which customs, which conventions, which continuity? Right. What do we want to maintain and what do we want to allow to go?
Which would connect to the moral order, larger moral order.
That's why that in that order, you want to have the moral order in place first, and then you want to talk about customs.
Another thing about the customs and continuity, and this is something, now this is the one that really frustrates me. Okay, because sometimes when people who have a lame, pathetic view of conservatism, they just see conservatism is maintaining the status quo, which means maintaining it by all the forces necessary, which means fascism, which means totalitarianism,
right,
which means everybody cookie-cuttered into the same thing. Traditional principle conservatism has this second principle of customs and stuff because they recognize that they are against top-down, centralized command control of societies and people because they recognize that people are all different and cultures are different and individual towns are different, individual families are different, and they develop their own customs, their own sort of ways that they deal with each other, their own sort of ways that they go in and out of each other, the way they trade with each other, or their own traditions and stuff.
Sure.
And that, while in light of the larger moral order, maybe there's a reason to be against a certain custom, for the most part, they want to err on the side of, if some town has a local tradition or custom, and that's the way that it works, and it actually works and thrives in the town, then don't touch it. Right.
Right.
Don't touch it because you're the expert planner who knows better than them how to plan all the villages and all the towns of the country. Leave it alone. There is this respect for the diversity of human culture and human like life that is in there. And it's like you need to respect that sense of continuity and only change it very carefully and very advisedly. You shouldn't go in there willy-nilly and change it. So conservatism believes in, principled traditional conservatism believes in the diversity of human experience. It doesn't believe in a top-down, there's a small group of people that knows what's right for everybody.
Right. And that the differences among people like that are delightful.
Mm-hmm.
They're wonderful. You want Louisiana culture to be different than Maine culture and California culture and Indian culture and African culture. And
that's
okay.
You want it all different.
Yeah, you want that because there are things that everybody sees that the others don't see bring new and wonderful things to light because they were able to pursue freely their own humanity and their own culture.
If anybody wants a slight practical and charming application and even explication of this, you can read Chesterton's essay, Cheese.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Which he basically uses the same idea.
That's right. You touched on several of the next few principles that he mentions here. First, the third one is conservatives believe what may be called the principle of prescription, which is the idea that you're standing on the shoulders of giants, and that what they have accomplished and what the wisdom they've accomplished needs to be passed on to you and prescribed, in a sense, to the next generation. Fourth, conservatives are guided by their principle of prudence. They recognize that slow, careful wisdom is better than impulsive reactions to things, and so on. But I'm going to jump down to the sixth one here, where it says, conservatives are chastened by their principle of imperfectibility. And I think this is connected a little bit to that idea of hubris or properly understand humility that comes from recognizing that we're under some sort of larger thing. Here's the principle of imperfectibility. If you think in an utopian way, you think your goal is to perfect everything in the system around you. But if you think in the conservative way, you recognize that while you should be doing good and bringing as much good as possible in your sphere, you don't feel like a failure if you haven't perfected it.
Right. And,
you know?
And you don't have delusions of grandeur that you even can perfect.
That's right. Who really can eliminate poverty from the world?
Right.
You can't do it.
That doesn't mean you stop helping the poor.
Amen.
It just means you know you're never going to wipe the thing out.
The good, the joy of it, you'd think that, well, that will keep you from actually working hard to eliminate poverty in the lives of those who you are actually in contact with, but it doesn't. It's just the opposite.
On the contrary.
Yeah, it actually makes it possible for you to not feel like a failure if not every single person is out of poverty.
Yeah, that's the paradox of it. People would think, well, if you don't believe poverty can be eliminated, why would you help the poor? And my retort is, if you really believed your job is to eliminate poverty, how do you not burn out? Like, because you're always going to fail and fall short, and there's always going to be more poor people and systems bigger than you that you can't change. It seems like if you don't believe your job is to eliminate the thing because you can't, that actually gives you more impetus to actually help poor people, because now you feel like you can actually do something. Well, I can't end poverty.
Right.
But I can go help that guy, like exactly. down the street or something like that. There's a sense of locality and smallness in a conservative. That's probably why in America, you know, limited government is such a big deal and federalism becomes such a big deal. There's a sense of smallness in the conservative mind that it's better to keep things local and small and within your own sphere rather than these grand paradigmatic transformations of everything. This is, by the way, this is one of the things where you can distinguish in like what people think are conservatism. You could point and say, well, not really. Like neoconservatism, like it's called neoconservatism, is really just classical liberalism that joined up with traditional conservatives against communism. All right? Because if you look at neoconservatism, a lot of them are really big into, like, let's invade these other countries, topple their dictatorships, and set up secular democracies.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because secular liberal democracy is what's going to save the world, right? It's this kind of continued enlightenment sort of idea that secular democracy, there's still in some neoconservative thought, I'm pretty sure there's exceptions, but in some neoconservative thought, there is this kind of utopic vision. If we just push secular American democratic system across the globe, we'll have peace on earth in some way, which a traditional conservative would look at that and say no. All right, even if we think democracy is good, even if we thought secularism was good, which that's a little tricky, but even if we thought those individual things were good in some way, we would never at all think that somehow we're going to save the world by it. That's and you know, when those ventures fall apart or fall flat or run aground, we're like not surprised.
One of the others here is the eighth one is conservatives uphold voluntary community quite as they oppose involuntary collectivism. Mm-hmm. And that plays into what we were just saying, I think, now, too, because the idea that we can bring about a utopian world is going to have to be done by involuntary means. That is, eventually you got to force some people.
Yeah.
To do it. And the conservative is the guy who actually believes in true liberalism, true freedom of the individual. Not freedom, autonomous freedom, which is, I think, what gets the right into trouble sometimes. Well, the left certainly, but the right too.
Right.
Because you've got, how can I say this? Freedom to make other people do what you want done is not freedom.
Right.
Freedom has got to be something that's free for everybody, in which case it's going to have to be tied into that whole moral order question again.
Freedom is tied to morality, which is the traditional way it was seen. You can't be happy, so to speak, you can't be free, unless you're good. That's the old idea, which is why freedom is not equated with autonomy in a conservative mindset, which is you can just do whatever you want. It's like, no, that could very well lead to tyranny of yourself, to enslave to your desires and passions, and even destruction for yourself and others.
So I recommend this 10 conservative principles thing. I haven't touched on all of them, but you can see that there's loads there to be considered. And then I thought maybe we should look at this Paris statement again and look at a few of the spots in here. I think last time we talked about numbers 10 and 11 and how the description of Europe as a combination of a Christian mind and a classical Greek Roman mind.
Right.
And we went even so far as to say something we teach here at the center, that those two minds are not just parallel influences, but they actually came together in one person who was maybe the first to take the gospel to the Gentiles, the Apostle Paul, because he was trained in both sides. And so that the two of those things can come together and God can use them in a powerful way.
Right.
And I think he represents those two things coming together.
It's good with like Kirk's hesitant principles, let's call them that, and the Paris statement itself. It's good, whatever system you follow, to make sure that your system actually posits something.
Right, that's the point.
It can't be just constant repudiation over and over and over again about everyone's wrong.
Yeah.
Because that removes, but it doesn't give anything. It just leaves a vacuum. And I think in the Paris statement, somewhere early on, it might have been early on, but somewhere in there, it talks about how conservatism, typically principled traditional conservatism, often is characterized by a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of like, well, here's why everything is wrong. Here's why liberalism secular liberalism is wrong. Here's why progressivism is wrong. Here's why neoconservatism is wrong. Here's why Marxism is wrong. Here's why we're all going to, you know, hell in a handbasket. Kind of, you know, this is, it's all wrong.
Kind of giving a negative without giving a positive.
Right. It's like, well, where, well, what do you replace? And there's, in some ways, the imperfectibility thing can go, this is where it can, like, twist or pervert off and be like, things can never be fixed. Therefore, if everything is turning to crap, well, there's nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing that can be done. It's like, no, you can posit something that maybe can inspire future generations and serve as some kind of bulwark against the dismal tide.
Well, you can't really decide what's wrong with something unless you have something positive to compare it to.
Right. And
sadly, I think we get into the habit on the conservative side of most of these political debates. Many of us get into the habit of simply standing against what we see is going on that's wrong. And that doesn't help, really, in the end. I think on a Christian level, I think when we practice evangelism, we should be doing the same thing. We're not just saying, you can't do this and you can't do that. Don't, you know, smoke and don't drink and don't go to movies and don't, you know, fool around.
Dadgum movies.
why not posit a positive thing? And in so doing, you, like, give it, instead of saying, don't be tinkering with our definition of marriage, why don't we say, this is what marriage really looks like. Isn't it beautiful? Mm-hmm. And when people see that it's beautiful, they'll want it because it is beautiful.
Or at least they'll understand why some people do want it.
At least. Right.
So here we have in the statement, again, like a positing. Now, there is repudiation. It's both at the same time. Because, like, you can repute something and then posit something. That's a full orb sort of system. Because you're able to repute it because you can posit something. And so they're positing, well, we get to the positing part a little later, although they've started with the whole Europe is Christian, Europe is classical, those two things together, and it's those roots that provide Europe's vivacity and flourishing and its structure and everything, and gives it the strength that it would have and the sort of community that it would have and the rights that they care about so much. But they do repudiate something as well.
Yeah.
And they... Where is it?
You want to read 22?
Well, let me see here real quick. Let me actually start with 3, because there's a line in here. There's a line in 3. So in section 3, it says a false Europe threatens us, all right? And it talks about how the patrons of the false Europe are bewitched by superstitions of inevitable progress, which we'll get to that in a second. But there's a line in here that says... they are ignorant of the true sources of the humane decencies they themselves hold dear, as do we. They ignore, even repudiate, the Christian roots of Europe. At the same time, they take great care not to offend Muslims, who they imagine will cheerfully adopt their secular, multicultural outlook. Now, interestingly enough, in that statement, it may sound like there's some kind of slight against, like, Muslims. Well, they'll be nice to Muslims. But it's like, look, Muslims have a belief system, all right? And that belief system, it ain't secular and multicultural.
Right.
All right? What usually gets posited, all right, in Europe, yes, but even in America, typically on the progressive left, part of me also wants to argue on like a classical liberal and even libertarian strand. But there's this Enlightenment model of things that has worked itself out into this kind of secular, multicultural worldview. That it's, they call it in here, post-national and post-cultural. That we're not going to have nations anymore. We're slowly moving towards a global view of things that eradicates borders. Because as we all know, the only reason we have war is because we have borders. That's the only reason. If we didn't have borders, well, everybody would just be peachy with each other. We would be post-cultural, where that's the most interesting one, is the one they don't want to admit. But their multicultural worldview doesn't actually mean letting all cultures exist simultaneously. It actually means whittling down and rubbing down and whitewashing out cultures so much to where they fit nicely into this secular pluralist kind of view of things.
It itself is a culture.
There's this sense in progressivism, which again I'm connecting all the way back to the Enlightenment ideas, which includes even classical liberalism and includes even libertarianism, which includes all these things. There is this notion of the somehow perfect society is this secular pluralist society where all voices are considered equal.
Right.
And in some ways, there is something to that if it's carefully balanced and nuanced and, you know, given like that sense of continuity and locality and stuff like that. But when you wed it to sort of a globalized vision of like, we're going to make everybody like this, that's when it runs into, well, saying it runs into a problem is like putting it a little too mildly. It just comes completely absurd and also reveals that this secular pluralistic system wants to claim neutrality. It wants to say that, look, everyone else is embedded in some kind of cultural system that is prejudiced with certain beliefs and traditions, but to be a good secular post-Enlightenment pluralist person means that you've gotten critical faculties enough to deconstruct all that stuff and see how it's not really a thing that has any validity or any grounding. You know, you can figure out the architecture around it and see how, oh, it's really built up this way. And that gives me the objective critical viewpoint. And therefore, I can create a society that's run by these people that have this objective critical viewpoint. And we can figure out how to station everyone around and set laws that make sure it kind of hems everyone in. So everybody can enjoy their culture. You see the quotation marks I'm making with my hands, which means you can dress in your weird clothing and you can eat your weird foods and you can do your weird dances and rituals. But when it comes to the public square of voting, you better check your religion and your culture at the door. All right. It's weird. It's like, weird's not even the right word. I don't know how to express how utterly absurd the whole thing is. I pointed out that one line because this is one point where I feel like this really is the big weak spot. All right. Islam is a religious system. They are not secular. Okay. As a Christian, I greatly sympathize with them on this point. They are religious people. Whether they're extreme, crazy, extremist, radical, or whether they're, you know, a moderate just trying to follow the five pillars and, you know, believes in the reading of the Quran that says that the older stuff that talks about showing respect and tolerance to the people of the book and stuff like that is the way to really honor, you know, to honor God and stuff like that. Regardless, they're religious people, regardless where they fall on that. That's not secular.
These are deeply held convictions that they hold, that they have, that are not going to be dislodged by or modified by a sort of naked public square, as Richard John Newhouse used to say.
Yeah, there's this weird assumption by a secular pluralist mindset that they want to look at Christians and Muslims and Jewish people or just any old average citizen, but definitely religious people, and look at them and say, okay, sure, you can go to your churches or your synagogues or your mosque or your temples or your whatever. Whatever you're doing there is cool. You want to have prayers at your dinner at home, that's fine. You
right.
want to read
you can
your
practice your religion.
You want
you
to read your little books.
Sure.
That's cool and stuff.
It's condescending.
Right, but you know, I mean, you know there's no God, right? I mean, there's not really. I mean, if there is, we have no idea who he is. So when you step into the public square, you're going to act like there's no God. Right? That you're going to act like you can pretend like your religion is true in your private life, but in your public life, you better act like it's all fake.
And if this is being applied to the Muslims in Europe now, it's only an extension of what Europe has applied to Christians and America has applied to Christians over the last, 150 years or so.
Right. And it just doesn't work. I mean, the most radical examples would be like the extremist who, you know, you try and impose secular democracy on them, well, you have to impose it with like bombs and bullets,
sure.
as I've said before.
Right.
But even in like a moderate example, like oftentimes on the right, it's almost like a joke to say like, well, I can't wait for them progressives to have when they run into a Muslim baker who refuses to serve for LGBT, because Islam sees homosexual behavior as sinful as well.
That's right.
And people bring that up as like, aha, we're going to catch them in a trap. But I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, what is going to happen?
Yeah, how do you answer that?
Like what are you going to do then? What is it not that you're going to, with Christians, for some reason, it feels like you can get away with it, but if you start doing it with all religious people, how are you going to hide the fact or maintain the illusion that you're some kind of neutral arbiter rather than an actual worked out worldview that's trying to impose itself on other people? And if you don't get in line, well, if you're like super radical, then they'll use bombs and bullets. But if you're just moderate, they'll steal your livelihood. They'll throw you in jail. They'll crush your reputation. They'll demonize you in the papers. They'll do whatever. But it's an actual sort of worldview. And there's a pretentiousness to people who hold that worldview. I say people. There's people who are definitely on the left, but I even think people who would be characterized on the right who hold a kind of secular pluralist worldview as well. there's a pretension there that somehow we are the neutral, objective party and everyone else is mired in the muck of prejudice and bias, and therefore we're necessarily right.
And the sooner they can realize that that is itself a kind of religion, that is, it's a set of perspectives that are held to religiously.
Yeah.
As soon as they can see that, then they might begin to be willing to have an honest conversation. But until that point, they're no better than the kind of radical religious person of any stripe that is so committed to his principles, he's willing to do or say anything in order to accomplish the ends of his religion.
They even call it an ersatz religion in the Paris statement.
Yeah, yeah. Before we get to that, let's look at number 22, though. Because this is, in an extension of what you were just talking about, I think that there is a kind of ends justify the means attitude that comes with this blindness toward the religious nature of the worldview that they hold. And in number 22, it says here, our governing classes are advancing human rights. They are working to fight climate change. They are engineering a more globally integrated market economy. They are harmonizing tax policies. They're monitoring progress toward gender equality. They're doing so much for us. Can you hear the cynicism in that? They're doing so much for us. What does it matter by what mechanisms they inhabit our offices? What does it matter if the European peoples grow more skeptical to their administrations? They're doing so many good things. How can anybody complain about the accumulation of wealth and power and influence in, say, Brussels in the EU, or being run the EU being run by a lot of people who are not elected officials, which is what the Brexit people were arguing against. We don't really have any say over who it is that's telling us how to run our country. So, but their argument is, we do all these great things. How could you possibly stand in the way? Well, look at number 23. The growing skepticism of people listening to these people is fully justified. Europe, he says, today is dominated by an aimless materialism that seems unable to motivate men and women to have children and form families. And when they're challenged, a little further down, our governing classes say they're merely working to accommodate the inevitable, adjusting to implacable necessities. No other course is possible. This is the best way to go. Well, and anybody that stands in their way then gets labeled as a racist or a fascist or, is condemned for his backward attitudes.
I talked about the pretension and all that, because all pretensions are stupid. To be pretentious is necessarily to be a fool. Thinking of, what's his name, Dogberry from Much Ado About Nothing.
Yeah.
To be pretentious is to necessarily be a fool. But there's something extra absurd about this, because they think we're right, and therefore we have the right to impose this right upon you by whatever means necessary.
That's the idea. You can't justify the means by the ends. If you say, I've got good ends, I'm going to try and accomplish those ends in any way possible. And it applies to both sides. We see it a lot on the left. It's true. But we see it sometimes, the temptation at least for it, on the right too.
Yeah.
How often has it come up that Christians are tempted, because they believe that abortion, for example, is the death of a human being?
Right.
And it is, I think. I know you do. We are justified then in taking the lives of anybody who would take the lives of these children.
Right.
And isn't that a means justifying ends? I mean, ends justifying means kind of problem. So it's not just on the left. Here they are talking about it, but it's tempting for anybody, I think, with strong convictions.
Yeah, with strong convictions. It doesn't, I mean, it could be something extreme like the abortion doctor killer type thing. Or it could be something more like, well, I don't care who gets voted into office, no matter what their character is, whether it's a president or a senator or whoever it is.
Right. It's if he's like, for us, he's good.
I don't care. If they're for us, then everything they do is right.
Yeah.
And that's how it is. I don't care if, Milo Yiannopoulos got caught on camera suggesting pedophilia might be okay. He melt snowflakes, so I'm going to continue to post his things and act like he's the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Sure.
There is this tendency of, if my side is right, then that necessarily sanctifies every thing done to bring my side about.
That's right.
Which is always dangerous. All right, it's incredibly dangerous to do. There is this sense of like, well, if I have convictions, am I not going to live on them? But there's also the sense of that higher moral order, it's balanced, all right? Like people from like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, they had a similar idea of like all those virtues that are embodied, are harmonized in like moral order. I was about to say embodied, but they're embodied in Christ more than anyone else. But that are harmonized in that transcendent moral order, they all harmonize together. And if you just take a few out, then you completely, the whole thing collapses. All right. Sometimes you use the image of if you try to sweep up a place by taking a broom, but you just take one little strand out of the broom, or maybe just a handful of strands and try and sweep, you're going to do nothing except get your hands dirty and not really sweep up the place. You need all of it together. And a sense of conviction about this thing is unjust that's not also tempered by wisdom and compassion and love and graciousness and temperance in some way is destructive. It's
recognition
just
of the dignity of everyone else, recognition of the sinfulness of every individual, including myself. So my view of things can't be universal. It can't be. It has to be tempered with that kind of humility we were talking about before. But it ties into this idea that that once you're connected to something that you think is so important, that you have to give everything for it, that kind of commitment, then what you really have done is taken up a kind of religious position. Mm-hmm. And again, this secular humanist, materialist kind of mindset is itself a religious position, see? And that's what I don't think they can see. They're just as committed to that as the Muslims are, or the Christians, or the Jews are to their religious convictions. And seeing the world through that lens and think, well, then it's justified for me to take the life of someone else or to overwhelm him politically or to run him out of business because my vision of the world would make the world a better place.
Yeah, I said earlier that it was an extra foolish kind of pretentiousness. It's pretentiousness is always foolish, but there's the pretension of, you know, I'm right and because my vision is right and therefore everything I do to fulfill that vision is de facto right. But the secular pluralist kind of globalist vision that is spreading over Europe and America is extra stupid in its pretentiousness because it's I'm right in the viewpoint that there is no right or wrong. There's only I'm right to assert that all views are somehow equally valid.
Yeah.
Which is another way of saying like I'm right to assert that nobody's right or wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm going to create this pure neutral space. I am right to create a neutral space.
Yeah.
Well, to do that, you can't be neutral, right? You have to be 100% for the neutral space, and anybody who is not wanting to be neutral because they doggedly cling to their convictions, they have to be dealt with, right? This is something I remember I was taking a class last year. It was about like contemporary British literature, but contemporary British literature is hopelessly progressive, so it's just steeped in this stuff. Mm-hmm. But the conversation in the class was this kind of problem. You know, contemporary British literature, we focus on Commonwealth literature, people writing from when the Empire fell, it became the Commonwealth. So here's all these people from societies who are British influenced by British imperialism, but they're still foreigners, sort of, you know, like, well, they grew up in India or Bangladesh or something like that, or from Jamaica or something, but they're also British and kind of navigating that problem or so on and so forth. And it's a critique of, like, imperialism and all that, the usual boogeyman, all right, the progressive aside. But there was this problem that was raising up constantly in the class, or at least as the class went on, is this sense, well, what do we do? Like, because any attempt to say, because I was an obnoxious little gadfly, I kept pointing out that the critique is that these imperial types had no right to dictate to people how they're supposed to live and how they're supposed to do anything.
Right.
I was like, that's basically what the thing was. It's like to live in a land without history or tradition, to live in a land where there's no sort of impetuses upon you sounds like freedom and paradise. Right. But the question is, how do you realize that without enforcement?
Exactly.
I remember I said that, and my professor, who is like all probably quasi-Marxist progressive left, just pointed right at me like I had hit the nail on the head. Like, how do you do it without enforcement? How do you do this kind of, we're going to neutralize the entire space, and yet not be neutral when you're doing it. And it seems like a conundrum that this way of viewing the world can't get over, but it still wants to move forward, so it just moves on contradictorily. It says, we're going to be different than our forebears. We're going to treat the Islamic community well. How are we going to do it? Well, we're going to demand that they become secular pluralists.
Mm-hmm.
What? Like, yeah. How does that even work? We're going to do so much better in the Middle East than those dumb, you know, white patriarchal types at the end of World War I. Oh, they were so foolish. We're going to do so much better by, like, introducing, you know, democracy and demanding, you know, lines in the sand that they don't cross. And we're going to, and by doing kinetic military operations and things, that we're going to do it so much better than everyone else. And we just wind up being more bombs dropping and more random lines being drawn. We're going to, you know, we're going to help women empower themselves. So we're going to go to African communities and we're going to enforce contraception and abortion upon them, even if their traditions and their tribes and their very language itself is against that stuff and they don't want it. It's for their own good. We're going to be so much better than those colonial types from the past who try to enforce. It's this constant, this is what I mean by, it's not just pretentiousness, which is foolish on its own. It's like an extra stupid pretentiousness because it's a contradiction in terms. It would be bad enough if it at least was consistent.
It's a contradiction that they're blind to, too. So that's why they can be as enthusiastic about it as they like. But it's impossible, as you say, to say, I'm going to create I'm going to value a value-free zone. That just is inherently contradiction.
Yeah, it puts it better than I was saying.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they're doing. And so the sort of colonialism that they decry from the earlier part of the 20th century is exactly what they're trying to do when they insist on Western secularized motives for a people in Africa. And actually, we've seen, I think we've even commented on it, how the people in Africa have said, go away, leave us alone.
Right.
We don't want your abortions. We don't want your contraception.
We don't want your views on it. Yeah, LGBT people or something like that.
Exactly. We're not in favor of homosexual marriage. Leave us alone. And then that's the time when at least they have the opportunity to see their own contradictions, because they're saying, what could possibly be wrong with what we're trying to offer you? And then they suddenly see themselves as the very colonialists that they hated from 100 years ago.
Now, here is, for me, the real catch of the whole thing. Is that the problem with this order, besides the fact that on its own terms it's stupid, even if it was consistent, it would still be stupid, the sort of secular, pluralist, globalist way of looking at things, on its own terms just doesn't work. You know, there's no way you can harmonize all the disparate elements of human beings in a valueless, neutral space, like without either becoming tyrannical or, what is the same thing, wiping out all distinctions in some way. Mm-hmm. But the real catch is that you say they value a value-free space. And the real catch is that because we're human beings, I don't know, made in the image of, I don't know, someone who maybe embodies values, I don't know. But because we're human beings, it seems to me that we necessarily want meaning and value and purpose. So we necessarily create moral value systems, which are we necessarily create a binary, good and bad.
Right.
And necessarily, it's hierarchical, because what does good even mean if it's not better than bad?
Exactly.
That's where we always start. We necessarily start there. And the only way we don't, the only way we get away from that is if we, like, you know, read enough continental philosophy to become nihilist. But even then, we're saying the nihilism is good, right? So there's no way to get around that. It's the old chestnut about how no one's really a moral relativist, right? Which, all my life growing up was just kind of a, aha, gotcha, you know, kind of moment. Like, you know, well, there is no truth. Is that true? Ha, gotcha. And I didn't realize what was really happening. What's really happening is all human beings are meaning and value desiring creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what we do. We necessarily create at least that fundamental binary and hierarchy of right and wrong, good and evil in some way. The secular pluralist types of this false Europe, it's also in America, they do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're binary hierarchy thing is a destruction of all binaries and hierarchies. And their problem is they can't square that circle, right? You just can't. You're
right.
Just never going to do it. Our problem, if I could put it that way, is knowing that, okay, we recognize that we necessarily create this binary and hierarchy of good and evil. we're just going to do it. So it's like you said before, we're not going to have any morality. It's like, what morality are we going to have?
Right.
That morality necessarily means, though, that if we see that there's things that are bad, then that necessarily means, as we've seen, there's going to be things or ideas or people or whatever that we want that are going to need to be disciplined or corrected or silenced or marginalized. Like that part of it, the negative side of morality, I call it the negative business of morality, is unavoidable. And so I can sit here all day and be like, you secular pluralists, look at all the horrible things you're doing, silencing Christians, and eventually you're going to silence Muslims, even moderate ones, in your secular pursuit. But then I'm like, if I was running the show in like a pure, I don't know, Christian something, who would I silence and marginalize? And then suddenly I'm like, oh no, I better really think about what I believe is right and wrong, shouldn't I? Because this could be, because it is a dangerous business, Frodo going out your door, right? It's a dangerous business to really act morally, right? To really hold convictions. And I almost understand the conservative impetus. This is another reason that kind of leads me to be more conservative, traditionally, principally conservative, is I understand the prudence thing.
Right.
I understand the, changes need to happen, but we need to make them very carefully.
Exactly.
I can understand more the, local customs and traditions and stuff. Maybe we should be a little hands off or something. Like, I understand that kind of wanting to. It's like, I mean, I'm young and have enthusiasm, so maybe I can feel the, fight the power kind of energy of things. But there's another part of me that like sees when people do that and just rush headlong in, they just break more than they ever fix and cause even more problems. And then there's things they weren't thinking about that rear their head. And
that
I'm
they
like,
had no idea about.
Yeah, maybe there is something
unforeseen
to this.
Consequences.
Yeah, maybe there is this something to this prudence thing.
Yeah.
If you're going to try and be moral.
The conservative, is by his nature, recognizes that these customs and traditions and so on are a kind of slow cooked morality passed on, for better or worse. Sometimes they need correction, but to go in and break them just because they're there and replace them with whatever you impulsively want to do actually is a misunderstanding of the nature of slow cooked culture. That is, over the course of many generations, certain things become sort of classic for a culture because of the fact that many wise people along the way have trimmed them, right? So when you come into contact with a place that has a tradition, it's the conservative is the guy who says, I don't know what the tradition is there for yet, but I am at least going to try and figure out why it's there before I make any changes about it. That's a conservative mindset.
Right.
And it's wisdom. It's wisdom. There's so many things that you just said that I want to touch on, but I also want to get to this number 24 in the in the paper too, and that is that it puts into words some of the things we were just talking about the idea that a universalist mindset is a religious enterprise, not simply a virtue or a value-free zone. The universalist, I'm quoting now, the universalist and universalizing pretensions of the false Europe, and as you say, in America too, you're seeing it in America too, reveal it to be an ersatz religious experience, complete with strong creedal commitments and anathemas. It has to be. Mm-hmm. This is, quoting still, this is the potent opiate that paralyzes Europe as a political body. We must insist that religious aspirations are properly the province of religion, not politics, much less bureaucratic administration. In order to recover our political and historical agency, it's imperative that we re-secularize European public life. We must turn back ersatz religion. And it reminds me of a verse in the Bible that says you should be slow and reluctant to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. If religion is the place where these truths are best pronounced, and we think, well, we can do a better job of it through politics, or we can do a better job of it, as he says, through bureaucratic administration. Forget even politics. Mm-hmm. Once we get people in place that are smart, they become experts. They just run it themselves. Mm-hmm. The problem is, it's so difficult to see clearly about what is moral and what is virtuous and what's not. And so what seems to be virtuous on a very superficial level might actually be the repudiation of a deeper, more profound element of a virtuous culture. And so I think God is warning us in the Christian scriptures not to jump in to be a teacher. Teachers are going to be held to a higher standard. And this is why, because they are the ones that are actually recognizing where the bones of that structure are. Mm-hmm. And those bones need to be carefully delineated without damage to it or to the people that are being taught. And so if you think you can do without religion and substitute politics or even bureaucracy for the teaching mechanism, mm-hmm. you know, then what you end up doing is getting a kind of adjusted moral picture. And then once the bureaucratic administration is in place and can't be voted out or can't be changed, it becomes tyrannical. Mm-hmm. And it starts teaching what it really thinks is the best thing for everybody. Mm-hmm. But the best thing in their mind for everybody is a kind of neutralized system where nobody believes anything exactly in their minds, mind you. But the kind of pluralism that they've been teaching. So what they're doing is saying we think it's terrible that everybody wants to try and convert everybody to their own religious positions. You should just join us.
Right.
But they're offering this ersatz religious enterprise, as they say here. And the result is it's a kind of false religion, and we have to stand against that and shift the power of setting virtue in the minds of the people back in the religious sphere and at least let it be debated there. Because mm-hmm. The Christians and the Jews and the Muslims and the Hindus and the Buddhists are all going to be debating things,
right.
And that's where it should stay.
I'm interested in his use of the term, or of the word. He says we need to re-secularize European public life, because we've been using the word secular so far for the secular pluralist mindset. Mm-hmm. And I think how they're using it may be different than the way we're using it.
I think so too.
I think the way we're using it is a valueless system. Like, it's a system that has no connection to a transcendent order. It's disconnected from all that. It's not concerned
right.
with any
right.
of that. I feel like the way they're doing it is they're making the sharp distinction between secular and sacred, because they're talking about religious stuff specifically. But like, political life and religious life actually need to be separate from each other, because if one swallows the other, tyranny follows. It's a relatively old Western idea, a kind of separation of church and state sort of thing. And they're seeing here, it sounds like, that the state has sort of usurped the place of the church and become sort of the new religious center.
Right.
And that's not what it needs to be.
Right. Yeah, I think you've got a point there. And the way he puts it is it's imperative that we re-secularize European public life.
Right.
And public life means that life that is held in community with all of us,
right.
not so much our religious life.
Yeah, that's an actual point. I feel like it's probably not something we can go into now, because we've gone long enough on the train we are. But it is actually a point of contention, probably. Exactly how secular can you make the political sphere? I mean, there are some people I know, especially like in Christian circles, well, I mean Muslim circles too, but that there is no such, that the state is always going to be promulgating some kind of value system.
Right.
They're always going to be religious, so to speak, quote unquote. And that talking about it being purely secular in the sense of, that's the thing, it's like secular in the sense that it's not religious doesn't mean that it's going to be secular in the sense of being valueless, that the government's always going to have a value system that
exactly,
it wants to perform.
Exactly right.
And then the question becomes, well, what is the relationship then? Because you can have a wall of separation between like the church and the state where they're not the same entity.
Right.
But you can't have a wall of separation that these two value systems, or these two centers of value systems, aren't going to have to harmonize or work together or negotiate with each other in some way. It's like resecularizing public life doesn't suddenly mean we've solved the problem of how do we integrate, you know, Muslims into Christian France or something like that, or a Christian into like Muslim,
right.
A Muslim Syria or something like that. Yeah, it doesn't solve, for me, it doesn't solve the problem. I'm not sure it's something we could talk about now, but it is an interesting point of contention about what does it mean to resecularize the political life and keep the state and the church and state and religion separated? And what does that look like? Is it really possible for that to happen? Because I know I've read in like certain Christian circles, mainly Catholic, But in certain Christian circles, there is a definite, like, that whole division is complete hooey. Like, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. We need Christian monarchy back. You know, we need, it needs to just be completely collapsed, because if Christianity is true, then why wouldn't we want it running your state?
Right.
Kind of attitude.
I think you're hitting on something that really would require a podcast of its own. Maybe we should think about that for next time. But just to give a little tease for it, the idea of secular meaning not religious or not Christian is a misunderstanding of the word secular. Mm. So I think we should distinguish between the sacred and the secular, and recognize that the sacred has to do with worship, and corporate worship in particular, and secular has to do with the rest of life. But there's no requirement, certainly anywhere in the Christian teaching, that Christian principles wouldn't apply to every area of life. Mm-hmm. So when you say separation of church and state, what you're really saying is not so much I have to put my Christian hat on in the church and my political hat on when I'm out in the world, mm-hmm. as though those are two separate things. It's not that. It's that the danger is that the church will overtake swallow up all of the work of the political sphere, the rest of what we might call the secular world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean not Christian. It means bowling alleys and pest control and, you know, everything that isn't directly
infrastructure work.
Exactly. Computer programming and nuclear fusion and, you know, conducting orchestras. So it's basically all of our lives, everything that we do in our lives, except for the corporate worship part. That we would set aside as a time for God directly for worship. But the idea that the religious side can swallow up the other and turn it into a kind of theocracy, and that's mm-hmm. a dangerous thing for some of the reasons you just mentioned. But the reverse can happen too, and this is what the guys here are talking about, how the political sphere can take on the role of all that the religious sphere should be dealing with, and that stretches the definition of government beyond its purview in God's economy. God has a place for government in his understanding of the design of the world. But to ask of the law, which is the power of government, to ask of the law to accommodate and accomplish all the ends of the larger sphere of life, including the religious and the charitable and so on, is to ask of the law something that it can't possibly do. The law can't make people virtuous. Mm. We know it from the Old Testament, don't we? That the law is actually there to point out to us that we can't possibly keep it, to point out to us our sin. That's what the government is there for, too. To, in a sense, point out that murder is not acceptable in our community. There are certain things you can't do.
Right.
And there are punishments for it of various ways.
Because people still murder. You know,
because people...
law against it.
That's right. Even whether there's a law or not. But what the law does is point out that's something that you can't do. Mm-hmm. It doesn't point out you need to love your neighbor. The law can't say you need to love your neighbor, and if you don't, I'm throwing you in jail.
Well, it could say that, but it's not going to get the results that it wants.
It can't possibly accomplish it,
right.
I think. It has to be something on the larger scale. The sphere of the... We've talked about this in past podcasts a little bit too, that the sphere of government is actually smaller than the sphere of life. Human life, and it only takes into consideration a certain element of life, and it also only takes into consideration a certain tool. The law is one tool. There is the call to virtuous life, and that call can't be done by the government. The government can only stop you from being unvirtuous. It can't make you virtuous.
And
so, in that sense, the resecularizing they're talking about is actually putting the proper distance between the sacred and the secular, and recognizing that the secular world has limits to it and needs to stay that way.
Secular. Yeah, because the ersatz religion, the secular pluralist kind of ersatz religion, would say that, well, I don't know if they would put it this way, but what they're doing is they're trying to make you virtuous.
Right, that's right.
By their terms. You know, to be virtuous means to be a secular multiculturalist.
That's right.
Or pluralist or whatever, and they're trying to make you. If we erase borders, spread democracy, give everyone contraceptions, allow marriage to be completely, you know, autonomously definitional.
Right.
If we just do all those things, then everyone will be fine. Everything will be happy. If we somehow, you know, the reason there are wars and fighting amongst you is not because of the lust that wars in your members. No, it's because you have borders.
That's right.
It's because
that's right.
It's
and
because,
you've got governments that require things, or you've got churches that make you feel guilty,
or you have a family that puts
family
impositions upon
that's
you.
Right.
And so
that's
we're
right.
going to put you in a space where you can still have family or culture or church if you want, but they don't matter. They're not the big thing. You are the thing that ultimately matters, and we're going to let you know that you're the ultimate thing that matters.
You get to decide for yourself.
By forcing you to be in that position.
Kind of. Right.
We're gonna force you to be free, whether you like it or not, kind of thing. And their definition of freedom, meaning like complete individual autonomy enforced by a bureaucratic government. Anyways,
right,
the whole thing collapses, but it is part of the problem is them thinking the only way we're going to bring about this virtuous thing is if we enforce it by the government. Right, it's the only way. It's the same, and it connects again. All these things connect together. It connects back to the idea that, well, politics is everything. Well, why would you say that? Well, if you believe that the only way to get things done, including morally, is by legislation and political action, then of course politics has to be everything.
Sure.
Going to get
That's right. That's the only space where anybody has any power.
And so that resecularization means understanding that government can only do so much.
Right.
It can't. There's some things that it cannot do. The morals thing needs to be taken back to the proper moral sphere.
That's right.
Which was in and religion and education.
And it's in that sphere, whether we like it, acknowledge it or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's in that sphere already, because what we're really seeing right now, I think, is a clash of civilizations. We're seeing a Muslim civilization and a Christian, Judeo-Christian civilization bumping into each other and overlapping and trying to figure out what assimilation would look like.
And
that's
even,
what's happening.
And
what we've done is we've started, we've extended the reach of our Christian, Judeo-Christian approach into politics to a degree, and then given up the bases of that. We've said, well, let's just create this third thing, this secularized religion that it seems to want to have. If you trace back out of it where the values have come from, well, then they come from Judeo-Christian thinking, right? We should be kind to everybody, give independence of human beings are individually significant, and other religions don't think that way. You know, the Hindus certainly don't think that everybody's the same.
Right. Everyone has equal significance.
They don't. And so many of the things that the secularized religion is actually promulgating have their roots in this Christian picture. So in a sense, what's happening is the politics are a kind of secularized extension of our Christian, Judeo-Christian heritage culture in a sort of foreground, you know, to bump into the Muslim approach as it's coming from the other direction. In Islam, the state and the religion are the same thing, mm-hmm. right? In the West, the state and the religion have been separated from each other, as we've said just now. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking really at is a confrontation of these two sort of tectonic plates mm-hmm. of Islam and Christianity, Judeo-Christianity.
But within this sort of
insulation of a very thin veneer of political secularized whatever it is that's going on, and that's going to crumble, and then we're going to see whether or not the Judeo-Christian approach has any kind of gravity, and if it's been hollowed out, then it's going to crumble too.
Yeah, I was going to say the class civilizations thing. It's like a Judeo-Christian Western world and an Eastern, primarily Muslim world.
Yeah.
But even within the Judeo-Christian world, there's like almost two civilizations formed out. There is the traditional Judeo-Christian world, and then there's this mutation, this secular
right.
pluralist thing that's kind of grown off and kind of detached and become its own thing.
Right.
So there's like fights from without and fights from within. There's fights from within the Muslim community itself, but there's definitely this big,
Certainly
like
are.
These big tectonic plates, the way you put it, they're rubbing up against each other. And it's like it is really going to come down to which side really believes what it thinks it believes, and which one's beliefs can actually motivate people to action.
Yeah.
And it's possible that this, how do I describe it? They describe it so well. This this secular multicultural vision that gives us aimless materialism, a culture of repudiation, where we just negate everything of the past and say it's all bad, informal autonomy, which is kind of, that's based on an isolated sort of individualism, where everyone's just sort of on their own and just does their own thing, and we just let them do their own thing, somehow that's going to magically harmonize with everybody else's thing. All that stuff, I don't think it can stand on its own 2 feet, at least not without becoming hopelessly tyrannical in a very, you know, 1980s dystopian sci-fi movie kind of way. Like, that's just so ugly and just empty that nobody believes in it whatsoever, but it's there and how can you stop it type thing. And it will take, I mean, only somebody with deep convictions actually gets things done. And something that has no deep convictions, you're right, it crumbles.
Just like a plant that has no roots is going to get blown over in a storm, we're going to see how strong this Judeo-Christian mindset is within the hearts and minds of Westerners as this comes about. And you're right, I think all of the sides, both of the sides, the Muslim side and the Judeo-Christian side, have all sorts of internal fractures, all sorts of internal fighting. So it's going to come to the tectonic plates running into each other. That's going to happen. But the question is, who's going to be representing those two sides? Is it going to be, for the Muslims, is it going to be a kind of moderate Islam that is willing to, well, I don't see how it can be. I was about to say is willing to assimilate, but I don't see how it can be and still stay Islam.
Right.
And on the other hand, I could say the same thing about the Judeo-Christian approach. I don't see how Christians can assimilate to a kind of pseudo-Sharia law world. I don't see how they could do that without giving up their Christianity.
Right.
So it's going to come to who believes what the strongest. And I hope it's not going to be bullets and bombs, but in the past, how the history of the world is when these two kinds of things clash, it comes to blows. Because not, it's like an immovable force, and or what do you call it?
An irresistible force meets an immovable.
There you go. Thank you. That's what I meant. Neither of them can
gorilla
stop. Right. Right. Well, we recommend that you get a hold of this Paris statement and have a look at it. We think it's worth intimate conversations about it. I've got friends in Europe that are looking at it right now and talking to me about it, and I'm hoping to encourage people in this country too, because I think the same problems are showing in this country. It's not like it's a foreign problem. It's a domestic problem too. So let's recommend that. Other recommendations?
Another recommendation, I don't think I've recommended this on the show before, but if I have, then I'm recommending it again because it's that great. There's a blogger who went by the handle Bad Catholic.
Oh, yeah.
For a long time. His name is Mark Barnes. It's M-A-R-K. M-A-R-C is
okay.
Mark. And Barnes is spelled like it's typically spelled. Okay. He is a young man. He's a Catholic. He is my spirit animal, as they say in the geek culture. He's engaged with the post-structural, post-modernist, millennial world as a Orthodox Catholic, let's put it that way, and he does it brilliantly. And he's written a book, which is a collection of essays from his blog. It's called A Bad Catholic's Essays on What's Wrong with the World. And if you can find it, I think you can find it on Amazon, but I would search it, find it, go read his blog, Bad Catholic. He also has a website that is like badcatholic.com, I think it is, where he writes stuff. But at least get the book, A Bad Catholic's Essays on What's Wrong with the World, by Mark Barnes. It's, you know, I'm pretty sure as a Protestant, there's a few points of contention I would have with him. But for the most part, he is speaking to the world in a way that's just, it's what needs to be done. He's doing the work of like a Chesterton or a Lewis, in that he's taking the Christian worldview and speaking it to the world in their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
So that they can actually understand it and actually like can grasp it, and it's fantastic to read. It's just fantastic reading. So, A Bad Catholic's Essays on What's Wrong with the World by Mark Barnes. That's M-A-R-C, Mark, and then Barnes.
Very good.
I recommend.
Very good. Well, then let's see if we can't get together again next week.
Thank you. Well, thank you guys for joining us. This has been From the Center, and we'll catch you next time.